So I got my master's and came back in the fall of 1966. The Vietnam War was raging at the time, and so to not be drafted, I had to get into a school very quickly, and I came to Davis. So I came to Davis in 1967, January of 1967, and found this place a very good place. This is the place where the faculty knew the students' names. This was a place where if you had a problem with your transcript or graduating or something like that, you went to a human being. The human being was understanding. The human being was generous. I can wax a little nostalgic about that because I've seen all that change lately. And the whole emphasis on teaching has been gone. So rather than transfer to Berkeley at the end of the academic year, I decided to stay at Davis. So I did go down to Berkeley for the only summer quarter that the University of California had before Reagan got rid of it, and I decided that Berkeley wasn't for me. So I came up here, had met a girl who was an undergraduate. Her name was Jean Meyer, and in 1968 we married. I was a graduate student. We had a child, a son, 1970, Brian. He's 39 now, has a little boy, Finn, married to Jen Tierney. In 1972, I had finished my doctorate in medieval drama and went on the job market. And it turned out it was a very bad job market. It's never gotten better, but it was very bad. But eventually, I was hired at Loyola New Orleans in 1972, and we went there. My wife was not happy about going to New Orleans. She had made a lot of friends here. This is one of the problems with academia. And there was nothing for her to do down there. And it turned out New Orleans, for all its beauties and all its cultural richness, is also a very ugly place. They call it salt and pepper neighborhoods. But what that means is this block is black, this block is white. A black person cannot buy a house on the white side of the street. So there wasn't that much for her to do. We had a daughter in 1976 in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I was there on a sabbatical, or actually a faculty exchange. It was a very good thing, though I found that the further east you got in academia, the more stuck up people were. University of North Carolina is a splendid place, but it's so damned elitist. I don't think any Californian would be very comfortable there. I mean, it really is. We were living on Gim Gul Road, and everybody would say, "Oh, wow, you live on Gim Gul Road?" As if that were something really important. Anyway, we had Emily when we were in Chapel Hill, and we came back. And my wife insisted that we leave New Orleans and leave my job. And from a point of view of career, that was a great mistake. Right? It ruined the rest of my career as an academician because I had been assistant professor. The way it works, after 6 years as an assistant professor, you come up for tenure. Even here at Davis, which was a little more rigorous than Loyola University, 85% of the people who come up for tenure get tenure. And once you get tenure, as some of you know, because you have some of these faculty, you don't have to do anything. You know, I probably exaggerated for Gideon about these people making $120,000 and coming up from Berkeley to Davis twice a week to teach, but I'm not too far off. There are a number of faculty like that. There are also a number of faculty that are slaving away in their labs and a number of faculty who are doing splendidly. But there's also a tremendous temptation, which all of us, I think, would be susceptible to, myself included, of taking a job where you didn't have to do anything and still got paid. deciding not to do anything with it. There's no external reason to do anything with it. So I came back to California and tried to find a job. I stood in unemployment lines, sort of dodging the vomit that was on the floor. It was a bad time. In fact, when I got up to the person who was looking at my record, she said, "Oh, we have our PhD, do we?" And a couple of summers, I graded tomatoes down at Pitt School Road. Also a pretty ugly life. There are snakes and rats running over loads as you're trying to grade them. It's something the state of California does to keep the growers and the processors from killing each other. But eventually I got this half-time job in medieval studies, and I've always had it. But it's only half-time, and I had this family to feed. My wife stayed home with the kids, and so when Prop 13 came along, something that you're all suffering for, even though some of your families are doing well in terms of taxation, that in the end it ruined public service for the state. And my brother, who was working for employment development, lost his job. My other brother, who was working for night school, lost his job. My brother-in-law, my sister's husband, who was working with the elderly, lost his job. So it was a catastrophe. Yes?
I'm just curious, what was Prop 13?
Prop 13 made it a public choice about property tax. So what happened was property tax had been going up astronomically because housing prices were going up astronomically. And of course, the value of a house determines the valuation. So what happened was they broke that whole system and set a level playing field for a level field for all taxes. But then still you could tax higher later on. So nowadays you might live in a house that has $10,000 a year in property tax and be next to this old couple who had their house from before 1978, and they're paying $250 a year in property tax. So it was one of those popular reactions that we see in referenda all the time that has unintended consequences. So anyway, what I did, and this is a kind of lesson, if there's any lesson, is that I went to computers. They were brand new, even on campus. I went over to Sac City College, learned enough computer to do some stuff here in the humanities. Eventually, I got hired in it as a staff research associate, a staff position. So for the longest time, I was half staff and half faculty. And I used to regularly bring down the computer system down in Berkeley when it was in Berkeley, because as Ken knows, the computer cannot understand someone who's getting half promoted, but not the other half of him is getting promoted. And the computer language that's still used in UC is COBOL. So there's more spaghetti coding there than in all of Italy. So it was interesting. Every time I got some sort of promotion on my staff side, we could fully expect that nobody would get paid for a few days while they sorted it out. Up until the year 2000, that was my situation. I occasionally taught in comp lit, occasionally taught in the writing program, but in general, half of me taught these classes, which I love to teach, and the other half helped people with computing, especially faculty. In fact, if you look at this little room across the way, 174 of AOB4, you'll see it's called the Arbor. That was my facility for helping faculty. The irony was that whenever they wanted to get rid of medieval studies, as you can see, you're looking at the whole program. Whenever they wanted to get rid of it, I would say, well, gee, if you want to get rid of it, then I'll go off and do my computing somewhere that will be more remunerative. And this is called extortion. So So up until 2000, as I say, that went on, and then a new director came in and made it very difficult for me to stay there. So I went and taught writing, and that's, Sarah, why you see those really evil evaluations of me on, because especially as the Jesuits trained me, I don't have any patience for bad writing, and I have less patience for plagiarism. And you have a number of students, I'm sorry to say, who feel that if it's on the internet, it's theirs. And even when I catch them and sent them to student judicial for hand slapping, they would still do it. And their attitude was, they're going to be rich enough to hire an English major, and the English major can write for them. So yes, there are jobs for you out there, Ari. So. And so here I am, retired finally, just at a good time, apparently. And I wish you all the best in taking up the slack from people like me. Unfortunately, you won't have my job because it's already disappeared. They did get rid of it. That's the bare bones of my life. Now I want to get into some of the things that relate to this. The Second World War was, for my generation, definitive. It was definitive. And in my family, two of my mother's cousins died in the war. One, through an accident, a gun went off. There are various stories of whether it was an airplane or the 3-inch gun on a submarine. But anyway, he was killed in a military accident. The other one, my mother's cousin on her mother's side was killed in Belgium, and his body is still there. My uncle was from Spokane, interestingly enough. He married my aunt, who was my mother's sister. He had come down from Spokane. He was a brand new doctor in the 40s, and so he went with the Sixth Army across Europe, and never talked about the war. So a number of you might know relatives who are in Vietnam, and they'll never talk about it. I lost one friend in Vietnam, and I know why they don't, because it was pretty ugly. But Dr. Joe, his name was Joseph Sweeney, never talked about the war. And in fact, when he came back to California, he left his military trunk with us, with the scalpels and everything. He was a surgeon, and a souvenir Nazi bayonet that we used to play with, you know, digging in the ground. And everything is left behind. And there was this great vacuum. He had a family history of heart attacks, and so he died, sadly, in his late 40s, in 1957. But some years ago, I know, actually it was just last year, there was a female photographer, and I bet Jack knows her name, Lee something or other, who was taking pictures in Europe during and after the war. Anyway, she had a show, and it turned out my uncle, Dr. Joe, was in some of the pictures that she took. And so we sort of know a lot more about him because of this. And this is one of the things I want to get across to you that's very important for me and for the particular culture I came out of. He was part of the liberation of one of the camps. We don't know which one it was because there's just the pictures, but it shows him as a physician, as a surgeon, examining some of the bodies. And so the pictures are of that. And this image is extremely powerful because these are young people, innocent people, people who were ground up by human beings, kind of an ultimate evil, I think, for humankind, not only for the millions of Jews who were executed, but also the Poles, intellectuals, homosexuals, people that were considered wrong. And one time I was asked to show a film about a French film about the Holocaust, and for a bunch of honor students, asked me to come in and do it. The instructor was away. And after we finished the film, I sat down, as you're supposed to, and had a kind of round table about it. And the whole attitude of these students agonized me, because they said, well, we've seen these films before. We've seen this stuff. It isn't a big deal. I mean, yeah, it happened. And I said, well, don't you think that if you were growing up in post-World War I Germany, you might be one of those guards? Don't you think that you might be one of those people who was carrying out these orders? And they absolutely and completely denied it. They absolutely and completely denied it. And I cannot for myself deny it. I meditate on this, there's a meditation, all the time. The fact that we are extremely vulnerable human beings and we can be manipulated. And this is one of the ways, by targeting an other, whether they're Jewish or black or Asian or Mexicans trying to get a better life, and not feeling at all any compulsion or compunction about killing them, depriving them of life. So this has been something that our generation has had to work through, and it's something that you can look at maybe a little more objectively than we can, because we had uncles and cousins fighting and dying in that war, and not because of the Holocaust for political reasons. But it's one of those things that I really need to get across to you. Not guilt, but realization that, you know, bringing this down to now and here is a critical responsibility on your part. If you have the future, that is going to be it. It's a critical responsibility. For me, teaching has been a great joy. And I hope some of you think about teaching, because it is a way of sharing all kinds of things. The only thing I don't really like about it is what I'm doing now, and that is just plain lecturing and not interacting with you guys. Because I believe that in the end, you teach yourselves. That you go out after you've memorized all this stuff and regurgitated it in a paper. You go out and you decide what's going to be important, what's going to be significant, what's going to be real, right? That's for you. And I'm sorry that this institution doesn't seem to understand that. They don't treat you as someone who can teach yourselves. They treat you as something that you just sit there and take a whole lot of notes, right? And hope that the notes that you take somehow correspond to a final, which will get you a grade and that step closer to graduation. That's wrong. That really is wrong. This is as much life as anything else outside. And so if this is as much life as anything outside of this place, then you have the responsibility to do something about it. You have the responsibility to call forth those talents that you have and make them work, right? And not listen to some prof, even if he or she is telling you something that is a lie, right? Not listen to that person, okay? That is really critical for me. I'm not saying, you know, as always happens at the end of the year, you guys are the best, right? Except for Star. I mean, you are very bright. You wouldn't be here if you weren't. But I think you're also somewhat discouraged. I'm glad you've come, Amanda. Somewhat discouraged about the future, looking at all these old people that are going to be hanging around your neck into the next few decades. I plan to die at some point, if that helps. But it's really critical that you see your own resources. And what Eckhart was trying to do for you, I think, is very important, quite apart from the intellectual understanding of him as a 14th century mystic. What he's trying to do for you is get you to understand yourselves. Right? And that is really critical to me, is that you understand yourselves and not as a product of a nation that has made serious errors in foreign policy and domestic policies, and not as part of a gender that is either oppressed or being oppressive. Not as Jewish, not as Muslim, not as Christian, but as that core of self that you really are, beyond the self. That thing that, when it comes right down to it, is what you are. And I agree with Eckhart personally that that is God. That core of self is God. That's my feeling too, not just Meister Eckhart's. I really feel that transcendent being, that reality, way, way down, further down than you really want to go, because you're pleased with your accomplishments and pleased with your youth and your energy, right? But below that, the thing that's going to be there 50 years from now, the thing that's going to be there 80 years from now, right? That self is precious because it is God. That doesn't make you God, but it is God. It is this being. Well, Eckhart wouldn't have called it a being, as you know. Right? Okay, that was my bit. Now I get to do your bit, since I did say that education is yours. I'll take any question at all. This is the medieval style quad libet. What do you want to know, Brenda?
How did it feel transitioning from your Catholic shell life into your Mormon?
It was tough, especially since my first wife, I've remarried. My first wife was Protestant, and she saw the Catholic Church in a way I didn't see it, and that is a bunch of old white guys who have a problem with sexuality, right? And I completely agree with her now. I didn't at the time. In fact, I'd like to, you know, not take Catholicism off the hook. I think it should squirm on the hook for a little bit longer anyway. But to generalize this to the fact that the university is run by a bunch of old white guys, right? A few of whom are women, but most of whom are old white guys who don't understand you guys at all. And if they did, this place would be very different. If they did, right? And the government, through my union work, I often had relations with people in Sacramento, old white guys, right? Who are most interested in holding on to what they have, or holding on to young staffers if that's what they want to have, but. It's true, Amanda. It's true. There's a lot of sexual exploitation that happens there. It's part of the currency of politics. And what's astonishing is that more doesn't emerge. You know, you find out Strom Thurmond had a black mistress. I mean, think about it. Here is, you know, a super racist, and here he is making it with a black woman. So, but... The transition was very difficult because my ex-wife, one of the reasons that she divorced me was because I held on to a religion that made no more sense to her. It never made sense to her, but it became more and more and more obsolete, more and more and more evil. And basically, the problem, I think, is not with sexuality. That's only the symptom. The basic problem is it's a big fraternity. And so anybody who becomes a priest, even if they go chasing after boys, is a priest. And so we have to be very careful with them because they're one of us and not one of them. I mean, to show you how absurd it has been, the bishops debated for a while whether the boys were seducing the priests. They actually debated this. Can you imagine that grown men who probably, you know, still thought of their mothers as virgins, would nonetheless even entertain such a thing? Would even entertain such a concept? So I'm deeply embarrassed by the church I belong to, and it occurs locally. There's all kinds of problems with top-down administration, even locally, and obviously nationally and internationally. You have to hand it to the few nuns that are left who actually countered the bishops by supporting the health care bill when the bishops were, you know, still hanging out on abortion. So it is deeply embarrassing to be a Catholic right now. I do belong, I do believe, but man, I am so sorry. And you know, there was a Catholic complicity in the Holocaust. I mean, it wasn't as great as some people say. It didn't go up to Pius XII, but it was there. So you live with that. And then when Judith Stein becomes canonized, she was killed because she was Jewish, not because she was a Carmelite nun, right? That is fooling oneself. But as you can see, a superb question. Other ones? Yes, Ari.
Where did you find medieval studies?
You know, I found that in my soul. Seventh grade. I just loved it. You know, these things that I've been giving out, these books of romances, of knights and all that stuff, dragons. In fact, I can remember in the second grade reading a story in our storybook. So I'm, 7 years old, about these three hermits. And they're living off in this little cell. And one, they sing every night. They chant their office. And one has a voice that croaks, and the other one has a voice that is very weak, and the third one has no voice at all. So here they are every night going through the motions of the liturgy. And this young guy shows up and stays with them, and that night he sings the liturgy with them. He's got this great voice. It's fantastic, you know, and they beg him to stay and sing with them. And he says, well, actually, guys, I'm an angel, and I wanted to tell you, this is the way you sound to God. And I remember that. I remember that from the second grade. So I thought, you know, I'm on to something here. And that's why the monasticism class that Carly and you and a bunch of other people took is my favorite class, because I get into those things. I think it is a personality disorder, personally. I think, you know, wanting to hide away in a hermitage somewhere. But yeah, something I haven't talked about, and that is art. I'm a pretty good artist. And when in my junior year in college, we went to Florence, and I spent a whole year there studying art. And I just love it. I love the creativity. What Eckhart talks about, you know, that we create because God creates. And so that's what everybody says. Oh, you're retiring. What are you going to do, travel? I mean, what is this travel thing? I mean, California is one of the best places on the earth. Did you know that? Golf? Golf is the worst human activity that there is.
Do you know what it has taken with you?
Yeah. Do you know what happens to water? The use of land per person in recreation? It's absurd. And exercise, they have these little electric things that go around. Right? I mean, down with golf. Let's get the crew back and destroy the golf program here, our golf team. I can certainly believe the religion part of it, but no golf. and not much traveling. My wife and I will go on national parks, and I'll take a lot of nice pictures. But I really want to find that artistic self in me because, as you know, since all of you are artists in some way, you act or you dance or you sing or, you know, you're all great artists and you don't have a chance to exploit this. It's just not there. Some of you are writers, you know, and you won't, we have a culture that doesn't appreciate those things. So I'm going to appreciate it. I'm going to do a lot of stuff that way. I had some great art teachers, especially in Florence, who's this little woman, Teresa Ciamoni. And, you know, one day, you're always cheap when you're traveling. And so I had these little tiny brushes, and I was doing this and doing this. And she came along and said, "Kevin, nanabia paura, don't be afraid." And she took her biggest brush and went, vroom, 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 like that. So I said to myself, yeah, if you're going to paint, paint. If you're going to save money, don't paint. So I really want to do that. And I encourage you guys. I mean, it's going to be at night or it's going to be, you know, after you're checking things at Safeway or something. But you're going to have an opportunity to either do your TiVo or art. If I could get you to think about art, I think I watched 5 minutes of Seinfeld and said, yes, this is about nothing. Yes, they're right. They're right. Jacob, you liked it? No, thank you. Good, good. All right, other questions. Yes, Alex.
You teach all these stuff, kind of classic things, like this class, that kind of deal with, you know, different faiths, different stuff. And,
right.
How do you keep, your own faith from kind of coloring your...
Well, I imagine that it does, because you're so smart. I mean, you've psyched out teachers since you were in preschool. I mean, you know, the first 20 seconds, right, Ken? You figured out what this guy is going to be like. Tough, hard, you know, easy, whatever it is. But my approach, and if Roman Catholicism still believes, which it shouldn't, that it's the only religion, it's wrong. My approach has always been, let's understand whatever we're looking at. And understanding means being positive about their motives, positive about their accomplishments, right, rather than negative. I know there are a bunch of cultural artifacts out there, Bernadette knows about them better than I do, which we find personally offensive, right? Genital mutilation, all these sorts of things, slavery. You know, I think we're right to find them offensive, but first we better find out what's going on before we do this. I mean, child labor laws were really an important improvement in society, but it meant families had less income, right? And the whole push towards daycare so women could be liberated to follow their careers now has all kinds of unintended consequence for children socializing, right? Without what used to be in this earlier time, lots of personal cherishing by the mother and father, right? That stuff. So, you know, the idea is to understand. And so I can come in here as a Roman Catholic and just appreciate, as Thomas Merton did, Buddhism for its wonderful insights, Islam for its tremendous emphasis on the unity of God, of Allah. I mean, that is so impressive. I can see why so many people are converting to Islam in this country, because it's just attractive to have Allah there. And I think, you know, we owe so much to Judaism in this country. If you think about it, the only immigrant group that came to this country that knew about and desired education was the Jewish group. I mean, the Irish and Italian, my extraction, took advantage of it in time, but there's only one group that came knowing the value of it up front. And that's why at a university like this, right, even though Jewish population in this country about 5%, a typical university is 15, even 20%. Brandeis is through the ceiling, but
but half a percent
nationally it's 0.5%. Well, they, you know, every movement, as I once told Alan, has a rabbi of its own. So maybe it is 5%, and people are just hiding it. There was another hand. Yes.
Oh, did you always know you wanted to teach? And if not, what else did you want to?
No, this is weird. This is really strange. I started, my first day of teaching was here in Olson, downstairs, which is the computer lab. And it was Bonehead English. It was subject A, which at that time was marvelous. Nowadays, it's a joke. But it was marvelous because they only got the best teachers to do it, and you got paid more. And if the student got a C, they were happy because that meant they passed and they didn't, they could go on with the rest of their lives. So you had to be really tough in the writing so they wouldn't get a C right away. But I didn't think I was going to be a teacher at all. I thought I was going to be a scholar. And here I am giving away all my scholarly books and getting rid of all my notes because I will do some things. I'm hoping to translate the Vetus Patrum. I'm hoping to do that. But I thought I'd be a scholar. And I walked into a class with notes, yellow notes like this. Right? This is from about 10, 12 years ago about spirituality. And I started, you know, doing the board work and doing what I did for the first half hour or so in this class. And I noticed everybody was sleeping. Now, they were keeping their eyes open. They were doing everything that showed that they were alive and awake, but they were sleeping. And I stopped and I said, Carly, what's going on here? And then that started this kind of seminar style that I teach in. And in a way, I'm sorry because, you know, you look at your notes, you know, the final is going to be open note. You look at your notes, Gideon, what do you see? It's not relevant. There are stories. There are connections. There are stains, drawings on the board. Yes.
Curves.
Lots of curves.
Arrows.
Pointing things. And so you say to yourself, Lizette, this is a different kind of class. I'm not going to know what's going on here. There's not a PowerPoint with six buttons, and you know, then I go through the six things and show you stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that, except Amanda, what's, no, forget boring, because I'm asking you because Tony Famula does that. Well,
yeah, you're not interested.
Right.
It's with Famula, he has a problem with silence, of science, I mean. And science, it's hard not to just put the facts out there.
Right.
And the reason people like him, like they like you, is because he finds a way to make it engaging. But if he didn't, we'd all be asleep.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it. You don't want to be there. You're not impassioned if it weren't for a teacher.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned this, but I'll do it again for the camera. Seems to me there are three different kinds of classes. The usual one you take is facts, right? You learn facts, you get the facts, you stick them in your head, right? And then what happens? The next class comes along and you rely on those facts to get through the next class and so on until someone kicks you out of here. That's the most common kind. The second most common kind is a skills class, like the writing classes, or Italian, or French, or Japanese, right? When you're not really dealing with facts, you're dealing with how to create another culture in another language. The third class, which is mine, is how can we get a perspective on, in this case, the past. But the past, Dirk, is just as relevant as the present and the future, right? So how do we get a perspective? And I make you write like somebody who is long dead, according to every account. And one of my very best students, sad to say, better than you, Star, once complained, here she is doing stellar work. She just won an award for translation from Greek into English, just won a national award, said, you know, and she's ending her sophomore year. She said, my 20A class was the hardest class she's ever taken.
First D
you ever deserved.
You gave that a D?
Yeah. 68?
Oh,
okay. 68.
Oh,
no.
I thought the class, I was like, oh.
Yeah. By the way, that 2007 class was a superb class. Alex and Jordan and Zach were in it, and Christina and Jacob. Yeah. In 2007, you were there?
Fall
2000? Yeah.
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 Yeah. I was there.
Well, there were 100 people. Give me a break. But anyway, it was a very good class. It was very, very lively and very culturally aware. But, you know, all of the 20A classes, because they come in fresh and you can work with them a little bit. There was another couple of hints. Yes, Star.
Why do you wear the robe?
Why do I wear the robe? Well, it used to be because I look younger than I am. I don't look 66 for some reason. And so I used to wear the robe so you could tell me from the students.
Yeah.
No. You know, in fact, in the 20B, just last quarter, these guys, hey, why do you wear the robe? And I said, oh, it adds a bunch of class to the class. Yeah. And they said, it's classified? But my favorite story about that is a great lecturer over in design, Barbara Molloy, sat in among one of my classes in the back, and she was sitting next to this huge, hulking, you know, kind of leftover hippie named Adam, really neat guy. Right? And after the lecture, she got up and said to Adam, oh, that was a pretty good lecture. And he said, it's the robe, man. So that's why I wear the robe. Apparently, I'm more effective at the robe. And I have fashion tips from Christina and Sarah on how to keep the hood right. It really is a hood, by the way, guys. You know, I could, you know, just go around. Yeah, it is a hood. Really? Who's graduating? Who's walking? You are, and Amy is, and Brenda, you are, and you are. Good, good. But, and Christina, you're not yet. Okay. Because we got to know that. All right, other things? Yes, go for it, Amanda, down there in the well.
Time, place, and lifestyle that you would want to live in the Middle Ages.
You know, I don't want to live in the Middle Ages.
Like a vacation.
Yeah,
like a vacation.
No, they would have me burned as a heretic for boiling my water. I mean, look, I would find it, as a Californian now, very stratified. I would find, I mean, it isn't like the movies where they kick peasants in the face. Because
black knights.
No black knights. But you know, I really love California. I'm third generation now, and I think this is a marvelous place. And I've been to a lot of places, and this is it. I mean, the Middle Ages, you know, the cathedrals and all the art that they were doing and various things that I can really appreciate. But the entire life system, I think it would be like New Orleans, right, where women didn't have much in the way of standing unless they were nuns, right? And you know, if for some reason you had a scar across your face, like one of my best students, Matt Malone, I guess it was a traffic accident, he never explained it. He's now a very successful lawyer in East Bay, but, you know, he has this huge scar on his face. I don't know if he, you know, if he would succeed in the Middle Ages. There would be this kind of, what's wrong with this guy? I don't know, but it's something I've not really thought about, Amanda. I never, because I enjoy this so much. I enjoy you guys. I mean, Joseph is one a really bright guy. I mean, and Gareth comes up to him sometimes, you know. It's good. No, I mean, you all have your own personalities, and sometimes they're delightful, and sometimes they're frustrating. But they are great. Yes, high star. There's another hand over there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I ran into the dean of the biological sciences. One
good.
Of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not only this institution, it's a movement in this country, right? Where are the growing fields? Biotechnology, right? Finding ways to grow new hands, right? I mean, this is pretty ugly, isn't it?
I want two extras.
You want two extras? Okay, we'll see if we can work on that, Christina. But do you see, I mean, there was a time, without getting nostalgic, in which the arts were prized for making you into a complete human being, right? A complete human being, so that you could talk about Cervantes, you could talk about Shakespeare, you could talk about Brahms, right? All those things. And now you can get a superb job by talking C++, right? Right? And you know, sitting next to a terminal with a big bag of Cheetos, There's an improper model. I mean, I was talking to one student who has dropped out so many times, I think he's the next model for a yo-yo. And he said, now I just tell people, oh, it's a great pre-law major, right?
Oh, I see.
And there are people who take Latin because they find out that it's worth a couple hundred points on the LSAT. And since everything is test-based now, MCAT, LSAT, GRE, hey, there you go. So James has it up on the verbal and on the LSAT. But we're in bad times. During a recession, people don't pay attention to the arts. And if you die, then they'll pay attention to you because, you know, your stuff is now worth something. But up to that point, you're not really valuable. So that's why I say you have to make your own life. You have to, you know, take your classics. Once upon a time, this is amazing. Once upon a time, Hewlett-Packard and Sun and the other IBM were hiring classics majors because they made superb programmers. It was just another language for them. And I think it still would be true, but they don't have to anymore. But, you know, it is a great shame. But when you think about it, if this country is 200 years old, if the Roman Empire in the West collapsed in 476, then 200 years would be 676. And that was a hard time for the arts, too. Right? It's a hard time for order and organization. I mean, you know, I'm glad Ryan was here the other day to show us what a society could be, because the Canadians care a lot about the arts, and we don't. So I don't know what to say, honestly. You can be lucky and be like me and have a job, even though it's half-time. It's gold. I mean, it's great stuff. Andrew.
What advice would you have for someone who, when asked what they want to do with their medieval studies degree, doesn't have any answer?
No. No. Remember your Meister Eckhart, right? I want to realize myself as myself, right? It's amazing because there are a lot of people out there that could have been medieval studies majors or classics majors or art majors or music majors. And what did they do? Become engineers like my father. And the rest of his life, he regretted it. The rest of his life, right? But he had money, and he supported a family and all that stuff. But so that's what I would say. I would be honest, Andrew, and say, you know, you're asking the wrong question. because look at all the suicides that happen among dentists and anesthesiologists. I mean, they're on top of the world, aren't they? Dentists are making $250,000, anesthesiologists more. Wouldn't that be great? No, not if you're going to commit suicide. So be a human being.
I'll try.
Thanks. Zach, take us home.
I think at some point or another, each and every one of us has chosen, has been affected more by one medieval text than any other. Which text do you prefer?
You know, the one that's mistranslated is On Christian Doctrine. De Doctrina Christiana means on the teaching of Christianity. And there he lays out, God damn it, don't take the Bible literally. And he says this in the 4th century, people. He says that. And what do we have? We have, what, 45% of the American people don't believe in evolution? Right? 65% think that science is nuts about global warming. Haven't they been near a glacier that isn't there anymore? So that, for me, is Augustine at his best, saying, okay, let's look at this. If you take this literally, you're in trouble. And I think it doesn't just occur to, it doesn't just refer to Scripture. It refers to everything that you read. If you take it literally, you're damned. If you take it the way it's meant or the way that it's going to be real for you, right, then you're an educated person. Thanks, guys. Thanks a lot. This is the tie that I got arrested in. But it's also the tie I got married the second time in. So. Yeah. It would be just showing off, Christine. Thanks for sitting up here. I know it was hard, Carly.
Oh, I would have just called the sec if she wasn't in the lobby.
So you saw that about making up the discussion?
Funnily enough, for change management, and I told her, I was like, and I'm just going to be frank with you, I was like, you know, I just call on for you when you know I have a party.
Glad you could make it, Elizabeth.
I would say, like, I would be dramatically, I would be traumatized if I could not go to see my professor's last lecture. You're going to let you have you guys got the more likely correct one because when I told Mara and emailed you guys, she's like, I hope you didn't send the wrong email. The real email was, she was like, please tell me you didn't. And I was like, what do you think I am?
I'll take a picture.
You guys got the
picture.
It would have shocked him.
Okay.
I would not do that.
So what birthday is
it's going to be my 24th. And then next year I'm probably going to do another review. You guys will probably receive another email because I'm getting 25 next year. Yeah, and it's one of those things where I, because I'm going to be a couple of years ago, and I ended up with suicide. Yeah. He never told you something. Yeah, it's attempted. So it's like every year, it's like, I do something because I made another year.
And you're absolutely free to sell it.
Yeah, it was kind of one of those things. Because I knew what I was doing, and there was like part of me in the back of my mind, and I'm just glad I have friends up here living with me, because I was still living in Davis at the time, and I was one of my friends, and yeah, I was just like, look, I know you have classes in the morning, but this is what I'm going to do if I go home by myself, so you need to go look at me. And so she took me there, and then they had me go back, and then they finally committed to me. And then after I got out, I called them, and I was like, hey, guess where I was? I'm on lots of medication now.
Okay.
It was depression coupled with untreated bipolar. And it was one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they finally decided. Because they finally found out that Frank had actually sat down and took the time, and he spent 2 years before he gave me a definitive diagnosis. So it's like, everything is all there now, because I'm stable on meds.
I'm really good.
I can still come to grass home.
Yeah.
I kind of love getting away without a wisecrack last class. I mean, you ever thought it was
so good? Oh, God. I'm so glad that you came in. That was great.
Yeah, Mara would have been here too if she wasn't working, because she's back for the summer, but she is staying tomorrow. She wants to be here, and I was like, hey, I know I have flexible time off, because I still have something like 30 hours of furlough left for
Stay,
because they were making us at one point come in every Friday, so we just all make. So we
pulled out, you came into the furlough.
2012.
Oh.
Yeah, because even if we bank the hours, I just figured, you know, I can take them when I have to. I wanted to be here. I told my boss that. I was like, you can either want to refer more of my sick time, or you can give me the afternoon off, because I was like, I got everything done. There's no real reason for me to come in tomorrow. I am reconciling health programs for the state. And that's what I do for 32 hours a week, because I go in and reconcile across three different systems. It's best. They have three systems doing the same thing, but they all don't talk to each other.
And I sent a list of the makeup discussions.
So that's my.
So if you're free Monday afternoon,
I'm a little bit mind-numbing. I was sort of laughing when he said that I would understand what counseling was when I'm out there, and that's one of the places where I've heard that we've met some really good. And so I was just like,
well,
I'll
have to remember
that.
Your goal is to go home and get your degree.
Oh, you already
have a degree. Yeah, part of my goal is to go someplace different. And I know the first 4 years I'm nervous, so I figure if I go someplace like New York for the first 4 years, I'm going to be totally distracted. I'm not going to be as good as if I go someplace in the middle of nowhere where there's really nothing to do. Because that's what my one friend's doing. He's in Missouri doing his first 4 years. He said he's getting so much more than he had stayed here. His godfather in UCLA decided to go to Iowa or Missouri. So he's like, he's loved in LA. He knows how distracting it can be. I figured, hey, I can always go someplace else and do a residency somewhere more exciting.
Good for you.
Time to win your business ownership. And after my little adventures through the metal health system, there's just a lot of stuff I'm just worried about.
Cover up all those cracks.
Yeah, I can do my part. That's part of my biggest problem. I thought this would
blow you away.
And I had to go to such an extreme to even be considered for treatment, because the first time sent me to a psychiatrist, they handed me a bottle of Prozac and they called me 6 weeks. 6 months went by and I stopped taking the meds because I was like, they aren't doing anything for me and no one's going to talk to me.
Barely.
And then I've been a doctor, all these things are going nuts. And apparently, you need to major in this. I have to find out what they need. You know, all the things he doesn't tell you.
I'm glad you stopped by. It's good to see you again. You will apologize to Gary.
You're all so small.
I'm right. No, that's all right. I'm glad you found the chair. Yes, right. Jeff.
Well, that was interesting.
You're welcome.
Have you heard the whole story?
I still need to make up one more discussion.
There's an email
not
about
exactly
when
that form.
Or schedule. You know. And you get it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's an added drama.
Yeah. Same. Yeah.
Okay.
So was that fun? Was that fun? Yeah.
Anything else, Quincy?
Thank you. That's very kind. And are you going to be any better, or are you going to die that way?
Quit. Then we need to unplug it.
I don't know. I don't know.
Yes. Well, let's push it beyond Friday night, okay?
Well, that's not the issue. I just I figured that having been in what, like 8 classes of you, I've now been instructed in how to use the tools to say I'm gonna write a better paper than I would have for the given problem.
Right, come on in. I'm sorry.
See you later. Thanks. All right, well, that's it. You ready? Yeah.